Institute. Can you explain who he is? He was recently speaking at the Republican Attorney General's Association, the group you're talking about, Raga.
That's right. We recently posted a transcript of his comments at that event. And what we know about him is that he is one of the most notorious climate skeptics or climate change deniers. He works for a group that has been funded by Exxon and the Koch brothers for many years, Exxon to the tune of millions of dollars. And so he advances. He's one of the merchants of doubt, as the book famously said. He's one of the guys who basically is determined to sow seeds of doubt and try to throw every obstacle he can in the way of necessary efforts to address the climate changes that are underway.
Lisa Graves, thanks so much for being with us, Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy and publisher of PRWatch.org and Exposed by CND.org. She is featured in Ava DuVernay's new documentary that's just being released on Friday by Netflix called 13th. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massou, Trina Nadura, Andre Lewis, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Paul Huckabee, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Miriam Barnard, Hugh Grant, David Crude, Ariel Boone. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, this is Joanne Hardesty from Voices from the Edge. This Thursday on Voices from the Edge, I will be interviewing Kathy Janelle Kiesner. She is a Marshallese poet and climate justice activist. We'll be discussing issues around climate justice, racism, and activism. Please join me this Thursday at 8 a.m. on Voices from the Edge.
The time is 5 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the League of Women Voters of Portland, presenting a forum on Portland and Multnomah County ballot measures on Monday, October 10th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah County Building Boardroom, 501 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard. More information available at lwvpd.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the U.S. has officially broken off negotiations with Russia over the Syrian conflict.
Voters in the nation of Colombia have rejected a peace treaty that would have brought an end to their 52-year-long civil war.
And Oregon officially began recreational marijuana sales over the weekend.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 3rd, 2016. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. Oregon officially began recreational marijuana sales over the weekend. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission, or OLCC, granted 26 retailers the first set of licenses to sell marijuana to recreational users, and these retailers were allowed to open shop as of Saturday, October 1st. New testing, packaging, and labeling standards for recreational sales also took effect on Saturday. The OLCC and Oregon Health Authority, the two agencies that regulate Oregon's marijuana industry, are allowing retailers to keep products on their store shelves that don't meet these new standards. By allowing stores to sell products produced before the rules changed, the state hopes to provide a smooth transition for retailers to sell existing product and for those medical dispensaries that want to transition into recreational license, according to an OLCC official. While recreational retail sales officially began Saturday, Oregon's medical marijuana stores had received waivers to sell recreational products temporarily until retailers could be licensed. Marijuana stores that do not have licenses will not be allowed to sell recreational users after December 31st. Oregon voters approved medical marijuana in 1998 and recreational marijuana in 2014.
The judge in Oregon's refuge standoff case dismissed a federal firearms charge today against Shauna Cox, one of seven defendants on trial in the occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge earlier this year. U.S. District Judge Anna Brown dismissed the charge after prosecutors failed to present sufficient evidence that Cox possessed a firearm in a federal facility. Cox is on trial along with Ammon Bundy and five others, charged with conspiring to block federal employees from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and U.S. Bureau of Land Management from doing their work during the 41-day occupation. Four of the defendants still face the firearms charge.
The Oregon DEQ plans to test an abandoned dump used for years by Precision Castparts to determine if the dump is leaching harmful toxins into nearby Johnson Creek. The landfill near Johnson Creek was used by Precision Castparts to dispose of industrial waste and was built without a liner that would have prevented leaching into the Johnson Creek watershed upon which it was built. A 2014 Oregon DEQ document revealed that Johnson Creek, just downstream from the Precision Castparts plant, was highly contaminated with PCBs, nickel, zinc, and chromium. It is not known whether the chromium was the hexavalent variety as made famous in the Aaron Brockovich movie starring Julia Roberts, as the DEQ did not further test the chromium after the positive reading. Precision Castparts continued to use the dump even after it was officially closed and the permit had expired. The company has been found guilty 10 times in the last 8 years of illegal discharges into Johnson Creek, including 2 times this year alone. The results of the DEQ testing are expected by the end of the month.
Multnomah County Chair Deborah Cafori reportedly signed a counteroffer to sell the Wapato Jail the day before a public hearing was held. According to Multnomah County Commissioner Loretta Smith, Cafori failed to notify both the public and the other county commissioners about the counteroffer. Wapato has been suggested as a potential site for a homeless shelter for up to 500 people. The vacant jail, located in North Portland, was built in 2004, but never opened. A public hearing was scheduled for Wednesday, September 22nd, but the day before, County Chair Cafori signed a counteroffer valued at $9 million to sell the vacant jail to an unnamed buyer. Three of the five Multnomah County board members are on record as being against using the Wapato Jail as a shelter. There are believed to be upwards of 3,000 people living on Portland streets nightly. It would cost an estimated $1 million to open Wapato as a homeless shelter, plus maintenance fees of $140,000 a month. The jail was built for $60 million and currently costs $200,000 a year to maintain. It was appraised for $8.5 million earlier this year.
The first species of honeybees in America has been added to the official United States Endangered Species List. Last Friday, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service added 7 varieties of the Hawaiian honeybee to the list. Honeybees around the world have been in sharp decline over the past few decades due to habitat loss and the widespread use of neonicotinoid pesticides. Neonicotinoid pesticides, called neonics, are the main active ingredient in Roundup and many other pesticides. They are believed to be the main cause of the colony collapse disorder that has devastated honeybee populations worldwide. The U.S. Department of Agriculture found that 44% of all honeybee colonies died in 2015, up from 35% in 2014. Earlier this year, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, for the first time, admitted that neonicotinoid pesticides had a deleterious effect on honeybee populations. The EPA is considering a ban on a few pesticides containing neonics, but its recommendations will be on a case-by-case basis. There are over 80 different pesticides containing neonics that are available to the public. Many more are available only to commercial users in the U.S., meaning it would be several years before the agency had the ability to test all pesticides containing neonics.
Hillary Clinton received a post-debate bounce in the latest CNN-ORC presidential poll. Clinton leads by 6 points going head-to-head against Trump, 51-45%, which reverses a Trump lead in the previous CNN-ORC polling. When third-party candidates are included, Clinton leads by 5 points, 47-42, with Libertarian Gary Johnson falling at 7% and Green Party candidate Jill Stein at 2%. Clinton's post-debate lead results mainly from gains on Trump among men from a 22-point deficit with that group in early September to just a 5-point deficit now and a big bump
in support from independents, who tilted toward Trump in the early September poll, but now favor Clinton 44% to 37%. The CNN ORC poll was conducted September 28th through October 4th among likely voters nationwide, with a margin of error of plus or minus 3%.
The Supreme Court today rejected more than 1,000 petitions for review of cases. Possibly one of the most significant petitions was from the Obama administration asking the court to review an appeals court decision blocking the administration's immigration plan. The case, U.S. versus Texas, was heard by the court earlier this year, and in June they rendered a 4-4 decision. The tie vote meant that the appeals court decision blocking the plan was upheld. The Obama administration had asked the court for a rehearing, but that petition was denied. The court currently has only 8 justices because no replacement has yet been confirmed to take the place of the late Antonin Scalia. It has been 201 days since the president nominated Merrick Garland to the seat, and the Senate has still not considered the nomination.
New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman sent the Trump Foundation a cease and desist order today, telling it to stop fundraising in New York. The order was given to Trump's foundation because it's not registered with the State Charities Bureau. Donald Trump's presidential campaign secretary issued a statement saying they question the political motives of Schneiderman's order. The Trump Foundation is under scrutiny over allegations that Donald Trump used tax-exempt foundation funds for non-charitable purposes.
Now, for something a little different, from H2O Radio, it's This Week in Water.
A better way to cook pasta? That and other stories on H2O Radio's weekly news report about water. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Methane is a powerful greenhouse gas that contributes to global warming. And a study to be published this coming week concludes that a large amount of methane is coming from reservoirs.
Yes, reservoirs like Lake Mead on the Colorado River or Roosevelt Lake behind Grand Coulee Dam in Washington are contributing to greenhouse gas emissions created by humans worldwide.
The new study will be published in the journal Bioscience, but it is already generating much discussion, mainly because reservoirs, especially those that generate hydropower, were thought to be carbon neutral.
However, authors of the report are concluding that each square meter of the surface of a reservoir is exhaling 25% more methane than previously thought.
The gases are created when an area is flooded by a dam. The organic material that is covered produces carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide, and methane, all greenhouse gases.
And added to that, many reservoirs are fed by streams and rivers that contain nitrogen and phosphorus from agricultural runoff that can stimulate greenhouse gas production.
The findings may have significant implications for the health of the planet. There are about 3,700 dams currently being planned around the globe.
So the results of the study? We may need to consider the negative effects of dam construction on climate change.
There's been a lot of controversy lately over which restroom or toilet people should be allowed to use. Male, female, gender neutral.
And we've all been horrified over the tragedy in Flint, Michigan, where water infrastructure has been contaminated by lead from corroding pipes.
And now, needed attention is being paid to other issues. Nearly 500,000 households in the United States lack the basic dignity of having a working flush toilet, running water, a bathtub, or shower.
A report by the New York Times profiled an area of rural Alabama where there is no infrastructure like sewage lines or running water.
One household is forced to attach a plastic pipe to a toilet and simply let the waste run off onto the ground outside.
Beside the problem of the smell, rain can cause the slap-together system to back sewage up into the house.
But connecting to septic systems or repairing old ones is expensive, and many cannot afford it.
In other parts of the U.S., people are still in crisis. Nearly 20,000 homes in the Navajo Nation in New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah have no running water, with some having to use buckets to fill toilets before they can be flushed.
With all the difficulties facing our warming planet, you, or someone you know, may be thinking of escaping to another location in the universe.
But one of the problems is going to be how to survive during that long trip to get there.
A tiny little creature that lives in Arctic regions of the Canadian Yukon may be able to assist solving that problem.
The northern pseudoscorpion is an arachnid that can survive very cold temperatures down to 20 degrees Fahrenheit without any shelter.
But perhaps even more impressive, the one-inch-long creature can survive underwater for at least 17 days.
McGill University scientist Christopher Buttle told the BBC that they think the arachnids survive because they shut down metabolically while underwater.
Studying the pseudoscorpions to learn how they do that might help prepare future astronauts for exploration of Mars or maybe even more distant planets.
Drill, baby, drill. That's what farmers in drought-stricken California are saying, adopting the slogan which has been used by oil and gas industry advocates.
The San Joaquin Valley is being drilled faster than ever for water, according to a report in the Sacramento Bee.
Last year, farmers sunk about 2,500 wells in the San Joaquin, the highest number on record, and upwards of $300 million will be spent this year to pump groundwater, according to researchers at the University of California at Davis.
The downside of all this drilling is that aquifers are being depleted of water that has been there for thousands of years. And another consequence is that the drilling leads to concentration of contaminants.
Recently, municipal wells were so depleted that children couldn't drink from fountains at a school in the valley because of contamination.
Depletion of groundwater also leads to subsidence, and some areas of the valley are sinking.
And as NASA water scientist Jay Famolietti told H2O Radio, when aquifers are depleted, most of that water is gone and not coming back.
It was only 2 years ago that Governor Jerry Brown signed a law that will limit groundwater drilling in the state. But the law does not begin to go into effect for more than 3 years. And until then, farmers are saying unapologetically, drill, baby, drill.
And finally this week, we all know we need to use water wisely and conserve when possible.
And we know the routine. Take shorter showers, buy water-efficient appliances, and make your outdoor landscape more drought-tolerant.
But one opportunity to save you might be missing? How you cook your pasta.
No kidding. Your linguine might be killing the planet by letting precious water go down the drain. Literally. By some accounts, a family of four uses 100 gallons of water a year just for cooking noodles.
So the folks at Epicurious wanted to find out if you could make pasta with less water.
In a series of tests, they found they were able to reduce the water by a third, and the pasta tasted just fine.
So then they thought, is it possible to just skip the water altogether?
And their answer was yes, by cooking it right in the sauce.
Now, this method was more successful with shorter pastas like your bow ties or your macaroni, as opposed to spaghetti, and they did have to add water over the sauce to cover the noodles, but the savings.
Less energy to boil water, less water dumped down the drain.
And one less pot to wash. If everyone in the U.S. cooked this way, we could save billions of gallons of water.
And you know the saying, a penne saved is a penne earned.
This Week in Water is sponsored by the American Water Works Association. Learn more about new water science, research, and treatment November 13 through 17 in Indianapolis. Information can be found at awwa.org/WQTC16.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Professor Larry Sherman about the neuroscience of prejudice. At 6, it's Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class. That's followed by Prison Pipeline at 6:30 with Multnomah County District Attorney Rod Underhill speaking about the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program, or LEAD, that Underhill's trying to start here in Portland. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, views and news from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, rain likely before 11 p.m., then showers likely after.
cloudy with a low around 51. Chance of precipitation is 70%. Tomorrow, Tuesday, showers likely, then showers, and possibly a thunderstorm after 11 a.m., high near 62, chance of precipitation 80%. Today in history, in 1974, the Cleveland Indians hired Frank Robinson as Major League Baseball's first of African-American manager. And in 1990, West Germany and East Germany ended 45 years of post-war division, declaring the creation of a new unified country. The quote of the day is from writer Gore Vidal, who once said, "The more money an American accumulates, the less interesting he becomes."
Tensions continue to rise between the United States and Russia, and today the U.S. officially broke off negotiations with Russia over the Syrian conflict. Both sides are accusing the other of causing massive civilian deaths in the Syrian city of Aleppo, the last main stronghold of what America is calling moderate rebels, but that Russia claims are forces belonging to the so-called Islamic State. A previous ceasefire negotiated between the two superpowers fell apart after U.S. airstrikes hit the Syrian army a week ago, killing or injuring 200 Syrian troops. China recently joined the war on the side of Syria and Russia when they announced recently that the Chinese military would provide aid and training to the Syrian army.
Just within the last day, over 6,000 refugees traveling from Libya to Europe have been rescued from the Mediterranean Sea by Italian authorities. The operation was one of the largest rescues ever in a 24-hour period. The International Organization for Migration reported that more than 130,000 migrants arrived in Italy during 2016 and more than 3,000 died during their migration.
Greek police fired tear gas and violently broke up a demonstration in Athens today when protesters attempted to enter the office of Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras. The protesters were mostly retired pensioners, angry at the recent implementation of new austerity measures. The new measures include pension cuts and tax hikes at a level that the protesters claim make it impossible to survive.
Voters in Hungary, at least a small percentage of them, went to the polls Sunday to decide if the country will participate in a European Union plan to resettle refugees. At the height of the migrant crisis in Europe last year, the EU asked member states to each take in a quota of the hundreds of thousands of people who are arriving through the Mediterranean Sea. Hungary's right-wing government found this so objectionable, they put the matter to a referendum. Sunday, more than 3 million Hungarians agreed with the government, but most didn't vote at all, while the vast majority of refugees caught in the snare of closed borders are still languishing in camps in Italy and Greece. Andrew Connolly with Free Speech Radio News has more from Budapest.
Days before the referendum in Hungary, campaigning reached extremes. On Saturday, at a rock concert organized by Jobbik, Hungary's far-right party, outside of the parliament building, skinheads could be seen giving Nazi salutes. On Sunday morning, at a service at St. Stephen's Basilica, some followers offered prayers to refugees. The vast contrast in attitudes reflects the polarization in Hungarian society based on fears about immigration. Situated halfway between Turkey and Germany, last year more than 400,000 refugees travelled through Hungary, most of them from Syria, Iraq and Afghanistan. In response to the crisis, the government constructed barbed wire fences on its southern borders. The country's hardline Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, was quick to label refugees and migrants terrorists and poison. Ironic, given that economic hardship in Hungary has resulted in a net export of hundreds of thousands of their own migrants. Do you want the European Union to be entitled to prescribe the mandatory settlement of non-Hungarian citizens in Hungary without the consent of Parliament? That's the loaded question Hungarians faced at the polls Sunday, referring to a European Union policy asking member states to take in a specific number of refugees who are currently stranded in the frontline states of Italy and Greece. Some voters, like teacher Terry Feldmar, disagree with the government and the principle of the referendum so vehemently they decided to spoil their ballot.
I voted for yes and no at the same time, so invalid. I gave an invalid vote. Because the question itself doesn't make any sense. And on the other hand, I'm against the government, and if I vote yes, it means that I contribute to the chance of the whole referendum being valid, and I don't want it.
For liberal-minded Hungarians, the government's hostile stance toward refugees is unacceptable. Nevertheless, more than 3 million voters supported the government's position to reject mandatory quotas, though turnout was only 43%. Many political analysts in the country think that nearly 5%, like Terry, decided to actively spoil their ballots to make sure the 50% threshold required by law for the referendum to be valid was not met. Though many mainstream political parties boycotted the plebiscite, one particular group was highly effective in mobilizing dissent. The Two-Tailed Dog Party, a liberal activist group, decided to satirize the state-sponsored propaganda campaign by distributing their own posters. While the government billboards linked refugees to terrorism and claimed the EU wanted to settle a city's worth of migrants in Hungary, their billboards warned about the possibility of a tree falling on your head and how Hungarians were more likely to see a UFO than a refugee. The party attracted the support of 2,000 volunteers and raised more than $145,000. Party President Gergely Kovács told FSRN he does not consider his fellow citizens as racist, but rather manipulated by government spin.
We think that this is the biggest mistake of our government, that they could bring the evil out of millions of people, and now there are millions in Hungary who are spending their days hating the non-existing refugees. Most of the people vote against something. That's why our government is always trying to find new enemies who the people can hate, and then they won't hate the government. They began with the opposition, later came the homeless, the drug users, the gay, foreigner companies, the banks, the EU. It's a very long list.
At a rally of the Green Liberal Party, Dialogue for Hungary, Speaker Reverend Balázs Zsuzs feared the referendum risks opening up painful episodes of Hungary's World War II past.
I think the Hungarian society is hurted a lot and wounded a lot by this campaign, because we have this historical memories when the hate and fear killed hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Hungarian people, and this is a problem, and this is what we have to say. No, refugees are not our problems. The immigration is a big problem, and our education system is a big problem, and the health system is a big problem, and the fear is a big problem between us.
A peaceful demonstration brutally repressed by an authoritarian regime using tanks and bullets, causing thousands of civilian deaths and prompting hundreds of thousands of refugees to flee across Europe. Such a description fits Syria today, but it was also Hungary 60 years ago during the uprising against Soviet Union-imposed policies. Surely now, it's a double standard that the government agitates so vociferously against refugees. At a so-called victory party Sunday evening, FSRN asked the Prime Minister's chief spokesman, Zoltán Kovács.
In 1956, the Hungarian Revolution produced 200,000 Hungarian refugees and prompted a big global program to resettle them around 37 different countries. I was wondering if you find any irony now in holding a referendum against the refugee resettlement program.
Well, in comparison with the 56 revolution is a lack of knowledge in history, I believe, an ignorance of history, rather. This is a completely different story. At that time, Europe was divided within.
Europe's divided now.
Right, but this is not a division line. What we are doing now, we wouldn't like to divide Europe. We would like to unite Europe and defend Europe, actually, in the face of a challenge.
Critics argue that without meeting the 50% voter turnout threshold, the referendum is invalid. But the government says the overwhelming support from more than 3 million Hungarian citizens who did vote hands lawmakers a political mandate. In many ways, the government has already won, as the extremist narrative against refugees grows louder every day, with no resolution to the humanitarian crisis in sight. Andrew Connolly, FSRN, Budapest.
Earlier today, Russian President Vladimir Putin suspended a treaty with the United States concerning the disposal of weapons-grade plutonium. The treaty had regulated plutonium disposal for both countries and limited the manufacture of nuclear weapons. The treaty was viewed as a symbol of repaired post-Cold War relations between the U.S. and Russia. Putin's decision was believed to be motivated by heightened tensions due to conflicts in Syria and Ukraine. Putin set out a list of conditions for the U.S. by which Moscow would continue to observe the guidelines of the treaty, though many of the conditions go against American policy.
The nation of Colombia has been in the throes of a civil war since 1964. After years of negotiation, the Colombian government and the rebel opposition, the FARC, recently agreed to a peace treaty. The treaty was put to a vote of the Colombian people, and much to the surprise of many observers, the peace accord was rejected. For more on this story, KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Sanjo Tree, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies.
The Colombian Civil War has gone on for 52 years. That's one heck of a long time. How did it start? Why are the two sides still fighting?
To some extent, they've been fighting for so long, I think they've forgotten why they were fighting to begin with. It's been so long. I mean, this has been going on since Lyndon Johnson sat in the White House. And it began out of the remnants of the previous civil war called La Violencia, another extreme decade of violence in Colombian history. And it began as a small Marxist rebel movement in Colombia in 1964, and eventually grew to, you know, over 20,000 fighters. They've been weakened since then, their peak, in 2000 or so. But they keep fighting, and no one seems to be able to win. I mean, this is not a militarily winnable war, as 52 years of counterinsurgency has shown us. So it has to end the negotiations. But there was a bit of a Trumpian tantrum, if you will, in Colombia yesterday, where the voters narrowly defeated the peace deal. It's a non-binding peace deal, but the President Santos has said he would respect the will of the voters. They're going to keep persevering to try to get something out of this. Both the government and the guerrillas have said they'll maintain their ceasefire for the time being. But everyone thought, and all the polls suggested, that the referendum would pass. But it lost by about 0.4 percentage points, which is a very close race. It was impacted also by Hurricane Matthew in the north of the country, in the Atlantic coast. So a lot of people could not vote or had trouble getting to polling sites. And they did not extend the deadline for voting, which cut off fairly early, I think 4 p.m., if I recall correctly. And in those coastal areas, people had very strong support for the peace process. So it is very conceivable that it would have passed in under normal conditions. It's a bit like the United States, where the center of the country, largely untouched by a lot of these events, voted against the peace deal, whereas the outlying areas, the coastal areas and border areas where the fighting has been most heavy over in recent decades, voted very strongly in favor of the deal.
I know that former President Uribe and the Colombian far right are celebrating now with this defeat of the plebiscite. What happens next?
Well, President Uribe, he's kind of like the Dick Cheney of Colombia in terms of leaders who are no longer in office but continue to just say nasty, venomous things. He hates the current president, his successor, President Santos, and because this was Santos's peace deal, just vilified it and said, "You're letting the guerrillas off too easy. They need to be punished." And nobody likes the guerrillas. Very few people like the guerrillas. They've had they fought for so long they forgot why they were fighting, and they practiced routine extortion, kidnapping, and massacres. And that's not what you do if you're a guerrilla movement. You know, you don't win hearts and minds by oppressing the very people you claim to be fighting for. But nonetheless, they can't be defeated militarily. This has to end at a negotiating table. And so people are angry, but they don't know what they want in place of this. There's no plan B. And I doubt people want this war to continue for another, half century. It's already cost, close to a quarter million lives in this civil war alone, and displaced 7 million people. In a country of about 45, 44 million population, that's a tremendous amount of people it's impacted. So this has to end at the negotiating table somehow, and hopefully soon.
This it wasn't like they just threw together a package of proposals and put it in front of the people. These negotiations have gone on for a while, haven't they?
They've been going on for years in Havana, and there have been all kinds of, you know, international observers and incredibly strong support from around the world, from, you know, whether it's the Vatican or the U.S. State Department, the U.N. You know, everyone assumed this deal would go through. So it was really a shocker. It was kind of like Brexit or the election of Duterte in the Philippines. You know, people didn't see this coming, and the voters just threw one giant tantrum, it seems.
I suppose one of the concerns was the they wanted to do sort of the truth commissions, that sort of the sort of truth and reconciliation approach, as opposed to punishing people for their role, simply punishing. I mean, was there a problem with the political groundwork? I mean, how did this thing fail?
You know, how else can you do it, though? It's kind of like, it reminds me of South Africa, you know, after apartheid. You know, on one hand, you could have just punished everybody and prosecuted everyone, but where does it end? Where does it even begin? How do you even begin to make those cases and document them? And how many decades or generations would it take to process all of that? And so it's very hard to you know, hold everyone accountable in this conflict, but, you know, especially when a great many of the abuses were committed by the government itself or their right-wing paramilitaries, which were closely aligned with the government. And they got off with a slap on the wrist, quite frankly. So, you know, you have to at some point, you know, recognize reality that there's only so much you can do. You know, it has to end, you know, in a negotiated way.
What happens now? I mean, do the rebels pick up arms once again? Do the paramilitaries go back to work? The government start fighting everyone and the peasants stand in the middle and get shot at? I mean, what happens?
This is the big question. Since there is no plan B and no one, you know, expected this to happen, on the one hand, if the FARC did lay down their weapons, as had been planned, there would have been a quite a big vacuum in the country, particularly in the countryside. And we're talking about, you know, very strategic smuggling corridors for drugs, for weapons, also lands that are, you know, where there's illegal gold mining, emerald mining going on. So there would be a rush to fill that vacuum if the state can't do it. And the state in the past hasn't been really good about following up in these kinds of things and filling those vacuums. So that's, you know, a serious problem to watch. But no one really knows exactly, you know, how this is gonna play out. The guerrillas, you know, seem intent on ending this. Their leadership is getting old. Many of them have spent their entire adult lives fighting in the jungle, which is a really miserable experience. From the short bit of time I've spent in the Amazon, this is not some place you want to be camping out for a long period of time. It's really hostile terrain, and they're ready to give up. And a lot of these fighters, they've never seen a computer, much less an iPhone, or experienced, you know, a music concert. They had a big the FARC, the guerrillas, had a big convention in the jungle, and they set up these stages and things. And for some of these soldiers, it was the first time they've experienced anything like that. So it's hard to grasp from the U.S. point of view, you know, how people survive this long with this kind of war.
Well, I know that you'll be following events as they unfold. Where can people find out more about your work? And give people your Twitter handle, that kind of thing.
Sure. Twitter is the easiest way to follow me. I'm at Sanhotree, Sanhotree, on Twitter.
I've been speaking with Sanhotree, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and director of their drug policy project. Sano, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
The Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine was awarded to Japanese biologist Dr. Yoshinori Osumi for his studies on autophagy, the process of the human body recycling itself. This recycling process is a self-cannibalization that converts damaged cell parts into energy when the body faces physical damage or decay. Osumi's studies opened a branch in biology that focuses on autophagy. The research can also be beneficial for finding treatment for cancer and neurological diseases. The Karolinska Institute, the distributor of the Nobel Prize, will announce the prize for physics on October 4th and chemistry on October 5th. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Rosalyn Scott, Kyle Koreski, Ken Jones. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News and H2O Radio. Our engineer is Mike Fotopoulos. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Rosalyn Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Abe Proctor and Joe Uris host the Joe and Ed Talk Radio Show. At 9 on Alternative Radio, noted intellectual Noam Chomsky speaks on elections and voting. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Stage and Studio, James Dixon talks with Ruth Wickler Luker, founder and curator of Boom Arts, dedicated to presenting provocative international and contemporary plays. And at 11:30, Andre Middleton hosts Art Focus. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in our recent membership drive. If you missed it, you can still contribute by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Get well soon, Lisa, and good night, Rosalyn.
Good night, Ken. Good night, Mike.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Later tonight, the Science on Tap lecture series presents You and Your Racist Brain, the Neuroscience of Prejudice. Dr. Larry Sherman, a professor of neuroscience at the Oregon Health and Science University, will explain how our brains react to people who are different and explore possible ways to overcome the automatic prejudice that contributes to racism in our society. The lecture starts at 7 tonight at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Street here in Portland. To learn more about the neuroscience of prejudice, KBOO News Director Lisa Loving spoke to Professor Sherman.
We are talking with Dr. Larry Sherman. He's a professor of neuroscience at Oregon Health and Sciences University. Larry's going to be doing a talk at the Science on Tap event about the neuroscience of racism. Did I state that right, Larry?
Yeah, it's more about the neuroscience of prejudice and how, of course, prejudice then contributes to racism, but that's about right.
And I see that you are affiliated with the Primate Research Center as well. Can you just start out talking about your research? What is it that you've been researching and how have you been doing it?
So actually, my day job is spent trying to fix the brains of people with diseases like multiple sclerosis and Alzheimer's disease. I'm a neuroscientist and I'm a professor here at OHSU, and we're just trying to figure out, we have made some interesting discoveries along those lines, and they're very exciting. But on the other side of the coin, I'm also the president of the Society for Neuroscience for the state of Oregon. And as such, I love to give public talks about interesting topics in neuroscience to get the public sort of excited about the possibilities of neuroscience. And that's where this talk comes in. Although some of the things I talk about in this talk about prejudice and racism when what's happening in the brain are relevant to my own research, which is kind of fascinating.
Here's the thing is that we generally in our society and around the world, we think of racism as literally almost like a social disease almost. We don't think of it as so much maybe wired in, and there must be a dialectic there. But talk a little bit more about your research. What was your scientific question that you were asking, and how did you pursue it?
So when I was starting to put this talk together, the first thing I do with all of these talks is read as much as I can get my hands on. There is a lot of very interesting science on this topic. There's some that's good science, and there's some that's not so good science. So I've been really focusing on the better, the higher quality papers that to form this talk. And the first question I had is, what is it about our brains that may be activated or different when we have a negative response to somebody who's not like us? And when we looked into the different studies that I could get my hands on, it's remarkable because if you're in an in-group, being, a group of people who are dominant in a particular culture or setting, they will have these really different responses in their brains milliseconds after seeing images of people who are in an out-group. And that really caught my attention. Then I started looking at the questions of how does this sort of automatic prejudice translate into behaviors that lead to things like racism? And racism really, the way I describe it in my talk, it's a system. It's a system by which one race has privileges and advantages over another because of race. And the physiological effects of that are also mediated by the brain. There's a lot of stress associated with it, for example. There are changes in hormonal levels that can have really negative impacts on health and development. And so those are really the types of things I'm focusing on in this talk.
So as we think about, and you're specifically really looking at prejudice, and then I come over with the word racism. It's not exactly what you're talking about, but it kind of is. So if I just have to put this out there. When we think about, say, prejudice, for example, we're often looking at a situation where, say, for example, a white person discriminates against a person of color. So as you look at the neuroscience aspects of that, are you studying the white person's brain or the person of color's brain? Do they experience it the same way? How I just have to put that out there.
Right. So again, just to kind of clarify that. So when we speak about prejudice, and this is something